So I actually have done this informally. So I'm Christine Peter. It doesn't show up here. There's no title. In general, I would like to flesh out the topics I'm more generally interested in. So in my group, we are concerned with multi-scale simulation of biomolecular system in the widest sense. Subtopics are development of coarse grain models to study peptide aggregation, also to study biomotivated hybrid materials, where basically a biomolecular compound is in contact with a mineral compound, for example, in these kind of nice biomaterials which you find here at the beach. That might be the case. So I will not talk too much about these things at all, but rather just suggest that whenever discussions come up in later talks about representability questions of coarse grain models, transferability questions of coarse grain models, I'm very much interested in those things as well. Also methods how to make coarse grain models bottom up. And a sidekick as well is that I'm very interested in interactions with mineral surfaces. So with that, I will already stop that part and just move to the third group of systems that we look at. These are bigger proteins, aggregates of bigger proteins, where basically the coarse graining is rougher most of the time if you want to study bigger aggregates. And I've picked an example. So first I would like to thank people, because later I will forget. Christoph Globisch, working in my group on this project that I'm going to talk about, and we are collaborating with a group of Marcus Tiziano at Carnegie Mellon. Tristan was a former PhD student of Marcus, and Venki, who's a postdoc currently there. So I would like to thank those, because otherwise I'll forget later. So I've picked a sub-problem of that entire project. So the entire project is devoted to a virus system, a Tau-P chlorotic model virus. So that's a big guy. It contains of 180 identical proteins. One out of those 180 identical proteins looks like this. So nice fold. They are, as I said, they're all identical. Also the fold on the, there is basically three not equivalent sites on the shell of that virus, but the fold on these three non-equivalent sites is very, very similar. So you could say that this core here looks the same for all of those colored things here. And then this protein has two tails, the C-terminal end and the N-terminal end. The C-terminal end, today I'm not going to talk about that either. So what happens with this guy is that two of those proteins shake hands with their C-terminal ends and form a dimer. That is stable, the dimer is stable in solution. So, and then from there on, aggregation starts. There is a proposed assembly pathway which involves, for example, the formation of pentamers of those dimers, and then with addition of more dimers, you in the end form the full virus. But that's nothing I'm going to talk about today either. I'm at the moment interested in what happens with this C-terminal tail. And that must be also somewhere in the virus shell. And maybe I should say something before I go into details, what kind of protein-protein interfaces there are in that virus. So if you look at, can you see that picture? It's a bit stupidly hidden here, but I cannot move that desk. So this is a full virus, and there is these, well, inequivalent site of identical proteins, and where do they meet? So here they meet in, so this entire thing is icosahedral. There is hexameric interfaces, so where basically hexamers of those dimers meet, and there's pentameric interfaces. And in all those, but in both the hexameric and in the pentameric interfaces, these C termini meet. And that's what we're going to look at today. So it looks like this, or I should have shown that earlier. So again, here is this hexameric interface, here is the pentameric interface. That means here come five of those C-terminal strands together, and here come, oh, did I say C? N. Oh, sorry. So I should flash back. I have now just used the wrong. Sorry. So the N-terminal ends meet. Just anything. Totally wrong, they call it formal, ever.
Question. So in solution, the pentamers preform.
That's what's being said, yes.
Yeah, and then the hexamers preform as well?
Not that I know of.
So how does it make hexamers? Do they go into
I mean, I must say the experimental literature I read is that basically these pentamers form in solution and then more dimers are added to it. And eventually when the entire capsid forms, naturally hexameric interfaces must form as well.
Yeah.
But it's not like you have preformed in solution also hexamers. That's what I found in the experimental literature.
What they think is that you get preformed pentamers and then come together, and then as they come together, an extra dimer pops in to make a hexamer at the right locations.
That's how I interpret the, I must push this to the experimental side. So at the moment, I'm also not personally interested in the folding pathway. So that's what I could extract, or what we could extract from the experimental literature.
You say folding, you mean the folding of the proteins or the assembly of the
Sorry, did I say folding? So
thinking of assembly.
So the assembly of this entire capsid at the moment we are not dealing with. I think we cannot with the kind of models that we are using, actually.
So what you're saying is probably what happens is the pentamers come together. It's a TS3 virus, is that right?
Yeah.
So then.
Actually, that's totally, to a large extent now irrelevant to what I'm going to talk about. So let's discuss that later. So what we were more interested in for this particular project here is basically the structure in those interfaces supposed that a virus has formed. So as I said, here five of those N-terminal strands come together. In this interface, six of those N-terminal strands are together. And experimentally, it's known that in this hexameric interface, those six strands form a nice beta barrel that's experiment structurally resolved. There's also mutation experiments that show that when you mutate the system, a couple of amino acids into glycines, those beta barrels don't form anymore. And on the other hand, in the pentameric interface, so where the same strands come together, but only five of them, the structure is not resolved. It's possibly unstructured. And that's where possibly cross-grain modeling could be useful, to look at these the folding in this pentameric interface. So what have we done? We have actually looked only at a very small part of that system. We have used the cross-grain model. That's the one that was developed in Marcus Tiziano's group by Tristan Bureau. It's a cross-grain model that has four beads per amino acid. So the side chain bead is based, the interaction of the side chain beads is assigned mostly with hydrophobicity, hydrophilicity arguments, and most importantly, that model does very well for the dihedral propensities of the backbone. So for folding small things, it does very well. So what we've done is that we've simulated essentially this system. So here comes in these six strands. Wherever it's read, we have position restrained those systems to the structure known from the experimental structure in the virus. So basically, the strands meet the way they would meet in the full virus capsids. And then we have let this bit, which is flexible, free, and see how it folds. So we've basically looked at this folding of this beta barrel. And then we've done the same thing for the pentamer. And that we've done with the cross-grain model, done cross-grain replica exchange, temperature replica exchange, MB simulation to study the full folding equilibrium of that thing. We've applied some clustering analysis and a free energy reweighting analysis of those clusters, looked at the stability of the various structures. And so what happens in the various cases? So the wild-type sequence hexamer forms a nice barrel. So this is the structure of the barrel that we find. If you make a free energy analysis, that's the most predominant cluster. So it's about 52% of the simulation is that cluster seen in the side view. So you see the beta barrel, top view. And here, this is the dots correspond to various clusters, and this is the free energy depth in KT. So you see that the deepest, the most populated cluster is a deep free energy minimum. It's a very stable beta barrel, as it should be. If you mutate now to glycine, you also get what you should get. So the beta barrel falls apart, you get lots of different structures, which are all within KT. So basically, this thing is essentially unstructured, that also corresponds to experiment. For the pentamer, so you do the same thing in the pentameric interface, so you also see no beta barrel. And you see multiple structures that are, again, of similar stability. So here, these three blue dots correspond to those structures. So now the question comes up, how realistic are those structures? I mean, this is a coarse-grained model. There might be lots of things wrong with this. And the question is also, does that now mean that really, in such a pentameric interface, no barrel could be formed? So what we did is we've tweaked the coarse-grained model a bit to see what happens if you just artificially tweak the coarse-grained model, make it more beta, seeing if then you maybe form a barrel or something like that. But you get, if you tweak this coarse-grained model, you get lots of beta structures, but nothing remotely like a barrel, and you get lots of structures again within KT. So it still remains unstructured. So that's basically just the onset of the question, because this whole talk today was a bit about what I hope what this workshop brings me. So and that's where I'm coming now. So what we could do now is we could, with a coarse-grained model of, which we believe is a good model, but still we don't know how it relates to a given atomistic description, how you can now go back from such a coarse-grained model to an atomistic model with something that's more than just stupid backmapping. So of course, in the first approach, we have now started backmapping on that system. So we have, coming back to what we have this hexameric interface, nice beta barrel, pentameric interface, allegedly partially structured, so there is structures, but multiple of those, which might be useful to experimentalists, but of course we need to test the model. So why would we backmap? We might want to hand those structures to experimentalists. We might want to hand those structures to a high resolution calculation. I mean, now in that particular case, probably not very useful, but nevertheless, a good reason for why you might want to backmap. Or we might want to assess the quality of a coarse-grained model if we assume that an atomistic model is more accurate. So what happens in this particular system after backmapping? So at the hexameric interface, here this is again our beta barrel. This is now a plot of secondary structures. So you have to read that like this. Here is time, and this is residue number. So you see six big fat yellow bars corresponding to the six strands. That means that over the simulation time of the atomistic simulation after backmapping, each of those strands remains nicely in a beta configuration. So this beta barrel is both in coarse-grained and in atomistic description rock stable. So after the atomistic simulation, it looks just like that. Okay, so that's a simple case. At the pentameric interface, it's getting a bit more tricky, so you can take two of those classes, again, backmap, and start an atomistic simulation out there. And it actually looks quite nice. So here you see there is some helices colored in this magenta, some other types of helices colored in this dark purple, and it corresponds in a way. So you see here certain helices being stable over the simulation time, same here. That's for this simulation, but then if you look at the structure initially and in the end, already by eye, you would say certain similarities are there, but definitely the model has moved away from there, which is not surprising because we say that there is more structural variation within KT. If the same happens at the atomistic system, also atomistically, it should move away. So that's not surprising.
If you take the coarse-grained side and simply run it for some time, do you see fluctuations which also then are more closely to the want those to be your atomistic system or not? So is it just a matter of fluctuations or is it more?
That's precisely what I'm asking myself as well. So yes, in a way, yes. But that's something that we would like to quantify a bit better. So that's precisely the point. I mean, we know that on the core strain side, those free energy minima are accessible within KT. So if you simulate for a while, they rather rapidly move away from a given free energy minimum and explore. Same happens atomistically. Of course, the atomistic model is a bit more stuck, but nevertheless, it will also start to explore. So by just back mapping and looking at structural stability, it's very difficult to quantify whether the models agree or do not agree, just by back mapping. It's actually even worse. So now we have used this was our artificial coarse-grained model, where we had yanked up the beta content, so where we would expect that this is actually a bad structure, also for the atomistic model, because this is a structure that was made with an overemphasis on beta structures on the coarse-grained side. If you now backmap, you actually see that all those beta guys fall apart. It looks like they fall apart. And the final model doesn't show those beta structures anymore. This was after simulating atomistically. So it looks, by eye, as if indeed the real coarse-grained model corresponds better with the atomistic model compared to this artificial coarse-grained model. That looks rather nice, but if we try to quantify this with measures such as root mean square deviation over time, dihedral angles over time, contacts over time, and funnily enough, all those measures weren't good. They weren't convincingly showing for individual backmap structures that indeed this coarse-grained model is a bad one and the other one is a good one. So, which brings me to my question, how does one actually quantify this? In both cases, the atomistic structure runs away from the coarse-grained one. For the good coarse-grained model, the ensembles appear to agree better. But when we try to quantify this beyond just this visual inspection, it's actually not trivial. It doesn't work so easily. And that's something that I would very happily discuss. And I would phrase the question then like this. How does one assess the difference between a coarse-grained and an atomistic free energy landscape, especially in such cases? And can we do better than just backmap? So the simple case that I have talked first about, so all the free energy minima are deep and agree structurally. So that was our case that we had in the first. So here is my coarse-grained free energy landscape, my atomistic free energy landscape. So back mapping means I go down vertically here. My minima are larger than KT. So what happens is that I go back, I back map, and then my system evolves somewhere here locally, and that everything nicely agrees. So that was the case of the hexameric interface. Another case that's easy to handle is this one. Still everything's deep, but they disagree structurally. So suppose you have here a barrel, you go down and you're not in the minimum, it goes away, but then stays stably here. So again, it's rather easy to say that these disagree. But now this thing I've been talking about before is this case. So you have shallow landscapes, constrained. Here, constrained, you can explore the entire free energy landscape. You can assign clusters, you can assign minima. Now you want to go vertically, back map. You will start to move also atomistically on that free energy landscape. And now I want to relate those two with each other and compare them. And that's what I think we should do when we do back mapping. So we use the coarse-grained model for sampling, we back map. Now we could do various things. We could now sample multiple atomistic trajectories and recluster somehow. That assumes that you can atomistically sample sufficiently that free energy landscape here so that you can, with all these independent simulations that you got from various first guesses, that then you can reweight those simulations appropriately, so match the sampling of the free energy landscape and get a picture of the atomistic one. That might not work so well. Or you want to measure actually those free energy differences. So you basically want to measure the free energy difference between coarse-grained and atomistic locally and basically close those thermodynamic cycles, if you wish. So you have this free energy difference, you have this free energy difference. Coarse-grained, you sample exhaustively, so you know all the landscape. That means that you can fill in basically the landscape down here. And that's something that I would be very happy to discuss with you guys, because I think this is something particularly for those kind of systems, partially unstructured proteins with a not very well-defined fold. Lots of people interested in protein-based materials will encounter that problem. So suppose you are interested in biomineralization, and there is, for example, we were talking about this, there is partially unstructured proteins. You might want to generate structures of those biological matrices with a coarse-grained model, generate atomistic configuration to then study the interactions with interfaces or with electrolyte solutions. Then you might want to do exactly this, right? I mean, you want to go to an atomistic description, but in a properly reweighted fashion, not just randomly picking structures from the coarse-grained model. And I mean, I do have some ideas how to do that. I mean, you have basically now the entire arsenal of free energy calculations available to you. I mean, you can do perturbation methods, you can do various thermodynamic integration methods, they can be reversible or irreversible. You can also do metadynamics or something similar. You could also use the coarse-grained free energy landscape as some kind of umbrella for the atomistic sampling. But that last bit, as well as metadynamics, might not be so appropriate in such a case, because those would rely on having to define an order parameter. While in this case, you have just clusters. It's not so obvious what would be an order parameter to describe these free energy landscapes. So that's also something to keep in mind when you think about these problems. Another thing that I would just like to mention as a finisher, so to say, you could of course now also do a replica exchange simulation with a resolution replica exchange. That would be a good possibility to do something like this, but that relies on that on the onset you already do a simulation like that. I'm talking more about the case where you actually first sample coarse-grained, because you don't know yet where it leads you, then you have the coarse-grained simulation and you want to do the atomistics later, which in most cases I think is more realistic than in the onset already starting with a resolution replica. But that would of course also be a possibility. And there I'm already at the end. There is no formal conclusion or anything. So I have lots of questions and I hope to discuss those with you guys.
Can you go one back?
One
slide back.
That brings me away from lunch.
Now comes my question from our discussion. You have KT. How realistic is that you have a free energy landscape on the atomistic level which resolves just a resolution of the order of KT?
Well, this particular system which I picked, I think, goes in that direction. I mean, definitely, atomistically, the free energy landscape is going to be, it will be locally more such. So it was not realistic to depict those two with the same smoothness. Otherwise, you wouldn't do coarse-grained. Yeah. So we assume coarse-grained is smoother. Still, atomistic means you're not stuck in deep shimmer, but you have refolding also atomistically. Nevertheless, the atomistic system is too slow to explore it entirely. I mean, I think that's just the case we've had here. You start out here, you go back vertically, and it refolds.
A similar point. If you have three different configurations that are both within KT, how do you make sure they are actually connected? I mean, how do you make sure it actually is able to move from one?
The coarse-grained, we've seen.
Yeah, your coarse-grained is easy, yeah.
Atomistically, we don't know. That's precisely the question I'm asking now.
Yeah.
So I know that I can go vertically. I know it goes away here, but I don't know if they are connected. I don't even know, I mean, that's why I've drawn it like this. I don't even know if this is a minimum. I mean, very likely not necessarily, right? I mean, that's why I've drawn it like this. And it might be that I have, coming from these three clusters, atomistically actually disjunct pieces of the free energy landscape. That's most likely. Otherwise, it would be, again, comparatively easy. That's what people have done. I mean, you can calculate a bit here, you calculate a bit here, you calculate a bit here, and as soon as you have overlap, you could again reweight, I mean, to some extent, and puzzle back together your landscape. The worst case is that this explodes here, totally disconnected from this one here and this one here. And in that case, I think the way I would propose is that you do multiple back mappings and basically connect those basins through some thermodynamic cycles via the coarse grained free energy landscape. So you have these free energy differences. But you would nevertheless have to define, of course, states on both free energy landscapes. So let's call this A, let's call this A, B, C, and you would have to connect those. I mean, it's a not trivial problem. Nevertheless, I think it's one of the problems. If you want to do folding with a coarse grained model, and if you assume that you will never get to the point that the coarse grained model exactly corresponds to an atomistic one, which I think we can safely assume that's never really going to be the case. Suppose you can nevertheless be at it with a coarse grained model that's sufficiently close to an atomistic one. Something like this connecting will be necessary. That's my belief.
Okay. But on the atomistic side, I mean, if you use one of these more sophisticated methods, would it make sense first try to sample it with brute force and smart methods in order to get a good enough idea of what the atomistic does, and then check if the coarse grained route would give you the same?
In principle, yes. I mean, that's what one should probably do. One should first do that for something that has comparatively well-defined folds, and do precisely this thing and check that it works. I mean, for something like this, which is partially unstructured, this is of course a worst case that I've drawn here. I mean, you could now do that with something that forms a helix and a beta sheet and maybe something else, and then try to do that cycle first before applying it to something like a dreadful case like this. Nevertheless, I think the true application lies somewhere here.
Sure.
I mean, there you would also want to have a toy model where actually the definition of a reaction coordinate makes sense. Because as soon as you have
a way to drag it, so
exactly. So then you could define umbrellas both here and here using metadynamics or whatever you want. You could also, as I said, you could also use then the umbrella coming from the coarse grain on the atomistic system, which would in an instant tell you whether the free energy landscapes are similar. Something like this would be for a well-defined system with a well-defined order parameter. That would make sense. For this system here, I have personally problems coming up with anything else that's just clusters. So, and then it's a bit difficult. As I said, the worst case scenario.
You're hungry? Okay, thanks a lot.